The following has been brought to you despite great danger. Please listen and heed the warning within. Godspeed and safe listening.
Good evening, my name is Shooter Jennings, and in 2010 I released an album called Black Ribbons. It featured the master of horror, Stephen King, as Will-o'-the-Wisp, a radical radio show host who was hopelessly clinging on during his final night of broadcast before public airwaves were restricted to government-approved transmissions. In this show, we're going to delve into some of the great stories and tales that inspired Black Ribbons. Welcome to Beyond the Black. Episode 5. Whew. Okay, Beyond the Blackers, we've wandered the darkness for 4 episodes. We only got 2 more after this. Feels a little sad, but it also feels a little exciting. You know what would be a dream for me? I would love to be able to do a show like this every night in a dark Hollywood radio recording studio, taking calls from you guys, having guests, getting deep on a lot of these topics we're talking about every time we venture beyond the black. Let's see if we can make that happen. I'm going to try. I'm going to lobby. I would love to do this every night, and it would be like being Will-o'-the-Wisp. You know, it'd be pretty amazing. Speaking of Will-o'-the-Wisp, I'm very proud to announce that the Black Ribbons Ultimate Edition is now up for pre-orders. Yep, go to bcrmedia.com and you can order it right now. There's even an option for me to sign it for the same price. It's up to you. It's only $40 and you get 2 vinyls, 2 CDs, one of which is packed with 75 minutes of unreleased instrumental tracks, remixes, live versions recorded during the Black Ribbons tour, even a tune that Jamie Johnson and I wrote that didn't make Black Ribbons, with Jamie singing on it. It's a pretty cool collection. And then on top of that, you get one of the new enhanced collectible archetype cards and a download card of everything I just talked about, plus every single episode of Beyond the Black and 5 full live concerts recorded during the 2010 Black Ribbons tour. Just go to bcrmedia.com and pre-order yours now. It's a very limited pressing, so get yours now, folks. And the option to get it signed will also go away soon, so I would go to bcrmedia.com and take care of that. Okay, now that my vocal advertisement is out of the way, let's venture beyond the black. Okay, tonight I want you to go a little further for me. I want you to sit back in your very favorite chair or couch, or even lie back in your bed. I want you to turn the lights very low and get the mood very still. I want you to open your eyes while you listen, though, because I believe when you're taking in your everyday surroundings while you're listening, you contrast in your mind a little differently. And we're going to get a little otherworldly tonight. The first song we're dealing with, and the main song we're dealing with tonight, is called Lights in the Sky.
Lights in the sky, tell me that I love you, tell me that I need you. Lights in the sky, tell me that I want you.
Well, you guessed it, we're talking UFOs tonight. But not the same old alien abduction stories you hear all over the place. There's plenty of those. I've always been very conflicted on the UFO thing. I mean, all of us are speaking a language that is crafted by Hollywood when we talk about UFOs in the first place. 9 times out of 10, when I'm watching a TV show or a movie about someone who claims to have been abducted, they're still describing the technology used by aliens in terms of what they've seen created in Hollywood movies. Don't you think that someone who's been kidnapped and anal probed by an alien would probably be describing it something unlike anything you or me has ever seen? The gray aliens with the big black eyes. I mean, that image was put out in an ancient film and everyone describes the same thing. It's like everyone's fascination with vampires, werewolves, and zombies. It's like somebody a long time ago had this idea of a werewolf, and it's literally still on the Discovery Channel in 2016 in some kind of Beast Hunter TV show being hunted. Look, folklore is awesome, like fairy tales. But we all live in a world where there's fucking idiots out there shooting and stabbing and blowing up as many people as possible at the same time as dying just to get more posthumous Facebook likes. Fuck Facebook. Jesus Christ, I hate Facebook. I hate Mark Zuckerberg. Fuckerberg. Ah. I'm sorry. Back to the topic at hand. I got a little sidestep there. UFOs. So I know I already told you earlier in the season, but my dad and I really loved watching things about aliens and reading things about mysteries together. Chariots of the Gods, for instance, as I brought up before, was a big one for us. We would watch the VHS of that on tour when I was on tour with him, on his tour bus, you know, over and over discussing these kind of topics. One that gets brought up very often these days on like the History Channel and the Discovery Channel is ancient aliens or alien astronauts. There's always that guy with the really weird hair talking about it on there. We're going there, but the Beyond the Black Way. The Anunnaki. The sun beats hot down on a little area of the world that we've all become pretty familiar with in recent troubled times. On the television, we saw flip phone footage leaked of a ruthless leader of this land as he was being hung in front of his people. We've seen a war started in these parts more than one time, the reason for which we've yet to been told truthfully. This land, this holy land, this holy, sacred, disgraced land. And like a mighty jungle queen, flowing south from the mountains of Turkey, the Tigris River empties itself into the Persian Gulf. To the west, her sister, the Euphrates, flows through Syria, patiently waiting to rejoin her love at the edge of the Gulf. In the center, this is Mesopotamia. She's a cradle of civilization, her land fruitful for farming and survival. Winter is past and the Age of Bronze is upon us. The light of a flame flickers, casting dancing shadows across the past. A man with a wedge in his hand crafts a tablet. He labors day and night. This man is changing the history of the world, writing the first pages of recorded history. This is cuneiform. This is the first writing system developed in Sumer by the Sumerians. The Sumerians also had an advanced understanding of mathematics and astronomy. The Sumerians were the first to divide space and time by factors of 6. The contemporary division of a year into 12 months, 24-hour days, hours into 60 minutes with 60 seconds, are all documented by the Sumerians. This division of factors by 6 was also later found at several other megalithic structures on other continents. Even the idea of computing a body's displacement as an area in time-velocity space is usually traced back to 14th century Europe, but cuneiform tablets popped up and said the Sumerians had this knowledge first. To say these guys were ahead of their time is quite a bit of an understatement. The Sumerian culture was an advanced civilization, almost a utopian civilization, in ways in which technology and science ruled supreme. The Sumerian civilization developed on the Persian Gulf, growing to strength at around 4 to 3000 BC. The plain of the land of Shinar, as it's also called, is the territory which after 2000 BC becomes Babylon. The Greeks named the region Mesopotamia, meaning the land between two rivers, most of which lies in the modern state of Iraq. Now, the exact origins of the Sumerians are unknown. The original homeland of the Sumerians is also unknown. It's believed that they came from the east, but whether by sea or from the highlands is unknown too. We know that they're not local people because their language belongs to an isolated language group. During the 5th millennium BC, people known as the Ubaidians established settlements in the region later known as Sumer. At around 3250 BC, another people migrated from its homeland, located probably northeast of Mesopotamia, and began to intermarry with the native population. The newcomers, who became known as the Sumerians, spoke a completely unique and different language from any other known language. By 3100 BC, the population of Sumer had increased to the point where people were living in cities as opposed to small towns and villages and farmhouses. They were into technology and they were into advancement. The Sumerians are amongst the first people to leave sophisticated records of their astronomical observations. Their fascination with the heavens is apparent in the large number of seals and cuneiform tablets unearthed of the astronomical nature. But as many of the television shows dealing with the ancient astronaut theories have questioned, were the Sumerians visited by aliens from another planet, and were they given tools and technology and knowledge from an advanced race of creatures? I mean, the Sumerians clearly spoke of ancient beings from the sky descending and teaching them in these ancient cuneiform tablets. The facts add up in many ways. Even watching the technology evolve, you can tell that something isn't right. When an architect designs a building from the ground up, or a carpenter builds a desk, or even a programmer writes a game, or a musician writes a song, the creator is intimately familiar with his creation. The constant desire to improve upon the original idea leads to the evolution of the idea. With many of the technologies of Mesopotamia, if you look down through history since the Sumerians, the further evolution was all but stunted. This indicates strongly that it was something taught, but not explained in many ways. But I'm getting a little too metamodern, I think, right now. So let's dig a little deeper. From theancientaliens.com, Sumerian understanding of time gives perspective to the writings known as the King's List. This chronicle of rule begins with the original Anunna supreme ruler descending from the heavens in his kingship. This is said to have happened after a great flood. This is believed to be referring to the biblical flood. It then lists all the Anunna rulers that followed and how long they ruled. Amazingly, many of them are listed to rule for hundreds of years. Others for much shorter times, like 30 years on average. But the first ruler held power for 1,200 years. Now, we can't imagine this to be true because our human lifespan is 70 to 90 years on average. However, consider that a highly advanced being, millions of years more developed than we are, may have achieved this kind of longevity. Consider your own lifespan average of 70 to 90 years and then compare it to the humans during the first century BC that lived 30 years on average. Now imagine what the effect of millions of years of evolution might have on our lifespan. All right. Now see, this is getting interesting. I want to remind the Beyond the Black listeners of a moment we had earlier in the series, when we were talking about the Nephilim and the Watchers, the Book of Enoch. If you take the Book of Enoch as biblical canon, we're told that the Watchers, or angels, were sent to Earth to protect the humans. And these angels were said to have striking white hair and be large in size. And these Watchers disobeyed God and they slept with the human women. And the human women gave birth to the Nephilim. Giants, deformed giants. It's interesting to me that in Darren Aronofsky's movie, Noah, with Russell Crowe, the Nephilim are depicted as these huge, like, rock monster creatures. But the idea is presented in a mainstream format that these were definitely otherworldly creatures. Now, I told you my mom is very religious, and I remember my mom telling me that people were getting very upset about Noah because it was such a different story than what was in the Bible. But I wonder if she knew that it was right out of the Book of Enoch, because she's very interested in the Book of Enoch. I think that's a pretty wild and cool way of telling the Noah story, if you ask me, especially something that had not been done before. Darren Aronofsky always takes an angle that's a little different, but, you know, he's a great filmmaker, and I think you guys should go see Noah if you haven't. Go rent it or something at a Blockbuster. Yeah, right. Anyway, to continue, my point lies in that small excerpt I just read you about the biblical flood and the Sumerians. See, they recorded that after this flood, the Anunna supreme beings ruled for hundreds of years. Now, common sense would say if you overlap the Book of Enoch Watcher story with the flood, and this one of the Anunnaki and the Anunna supreme rulers, the Watchers and the Anunnaki seem to be interchangeable. Things that make you go, hmm. More on theancientaliens.com. The King's List chronicles 433,000 years of Anunna or Anunnaki rule. This means that the age of the Anunnaki spanned a much longer period of time than the recorded history of all civilizations on Earth combined. The Anunnaki would have been on Earth about 430,000 years before any evidence of recorded history that has been discovered. We can't even imagine this amount of time since our limited experience with recorded history is less than 6,000 years total from Mesopotamia until today. Also, the account of people living these long lengths of time are also found in the Hebrew Torah and the Christian Bible texts called the Old Testament. The real question is just how old are these accounts of time? Likely much older than any of us can possibly imagine. A theory exists that proposes the Anunnaki didn't even teach humans the ability to write until the 3rd century BC. Or perhaps they genetically improved humans to add the intelligence to comprehend writing. Either way, it was not until the Anunnaki perceived the end of their era was coming that they decided to give the knowledge of writing to humans, to facilitate recording of that age of the Anunna for future generations to know. This would explain the tens of thousands of clay tablets of cuneiform writing that exist without any history of writing evolution prior to 3600 BC. Okay, so who are the Anunnaki we keep talking about? Are they gods? Are they aliens? Are they reptiles? Let's get down to the heart of the matter of who they are and where they came from and how they got here. From Anunnaki.org. The Anunnaki, or those of royal blood, are believed to be immortal gods that inhabited the earth during ancient Sumerian times in Mesopotamia. I did some digging, and I think I found the most comprehensive timeline explaining what most believe is the true story behind these beings. So I'm going to take us far, far away. Almost 500,000 years ago. I mean, if you think about that, you, me, and we really only see about 100 years ahead of us and 100 years behind us. We most likely only meet our grandparents, possibly great-grandparents. We see our children and our children's children, maybe one more generation down. Otherwise, it's all hearsay, pretty much, passed down through generations. Well, now with the internet, I'm sure that's going to change everything for generations to come. To take a quick right turn, actually, imagine what society 300 years from now will be like. I mean, think about it. They'll have everything from the past 300 years posted on the internet. I mean, from Facebook to whatever the next thing is, all those pictures will follow them around. There's no more blurring the lines or tall tales, pretending you're someone else. For the most part, we won't even be able to trust anybody without being able to confirm it on the all-knowing cybernetic superhighway. And then they'll take the internet away from us and we're all helpless. A war of information. I digress. Back to the timeline. Back to the Anunnaki. From truthbeknown.com. The Anunnaki are the major players in a paradigm making its way into popular folklore via the work of the late Zechariah Sitchin, an economist by education and profession and the author of several best-selling books, including Genesis Revisited, that explore ancient mythology and mysterious megalithic ruins found all around the globe. These various books also seek to demonstrate that there was, in ancient times, an extraterrestrial race that genetically manipulated mankind for various reasons. The Sitchin thesis, or Sitchinism, now embraced by numerous other writers who have incorporated it into what has become, apparently, a new worldview, essentially asserts that these ancient Sumerian Babylonian gods, the Anunnaki, are aliens from the planet Nibiru, which passes by the Earth every 3,500 years or so, at which time they planet hop and screw with us. Now, that could be kind of weird for people to take in, I understand. And I did a little more research and I found a lot of evidence that states that Nibiru actually comes around every 10,000 years because it has a circular orbit. But you know what? We'll stick with the 3,500 year rotation thing. We have more evidence pointing towards that. So Nibiru comes around every 3,500 years. From humansarefree.com. According to the Anunnaki themselves, our solar system has one more member, a huge planet that is orbiting the sun in a 3,500-year-long ellipse. They call their planet Nibiru, which means the planet of the crossing, because together with its moons, they form a cross image, and Nibiru is located at the center crossing. Because the planet has such a long orbit around the sun, the Nibiruans relied on the very thick upper atmosphere to shelter them from the cold, like a warm blanket. It also had the task of keeping the oxygen from escaping out to outer space, hence making life as we know it possible. Unfortunately for them, they were then faced with extinction. From the tablets. The volcanoes, the atmosphere's forebears, less belching were spitting up. Nibiru's air has thinner been made. The protective shield has been diminished. Pestilences of field made appearance. Toil could them not overcome. From circuit to circuit, Nibiru's atmosphere more breaching suffered. In the councils of the learned, cures were avidly debated. Ways to bandage the wound were urgently considered. Long story short, they've tried everything. From creating an artificial shield, which eventually fell down to the ground, to bombarding the volcanoes with nuclear-like weapons in order to make them active once again. But all their efforts ended in failure. Nibiru's scientists had one final suggestion to heal Nibiru's atmosphere. To pulverize very fine subatomic gold dust into the breach. Because it was so fine, the nanoatomic gold dust would remain suspended and in time completely repair the breach. But gold was extremely scarce on Nibiru. Though, within the hammered bracelet inside the asteroid's belt, it was abundant. Soon, rains were withheld. Winds blew harder. Springs from the depths did not arise. The Nibiruans grew restless and stopped worshiping Alalu for not being able to bring them salvation. Alalu was their god and ruler, and now they'd turned their back on him. Anu, the king of the gods, seized the opportunity and dethroned Alalu from Nibiru's kingship. Fearing death, Alalu boarded a missile-throwing celestial chariot and set its course for Earth, where he discovered gold. He delivered the good news back to Nibiru and requested the throne back, but instead, Anu promised him Earth's leadership. Anu and his two sons, Ea and Enlil, arrived on Earth to make plans for the future. He decided to give Earth's leadership to his son Ea and renamed him Enki, Earth's master. Alalu was greatly offended and challenged Anu to battle, but lost again. Alalu was sentenced to die in exile alone and on a foreign planet. Another very important aspect of this enormous lifespan that the Anunnaki seem to have, who lived for hundreds of thousands of years, some of them, this means that many of the Anunnaki mentioned in this article are possibly still alive today. Wild. But all right, so this story of the Anunnaki, this idea of another planet, Nibiru, is it possible? According to the New York Times, it's possible. From an article from January of 2016, two astronomers reported on Wednesday that they had compelling signs of something bigger and farther away, something that would definitely satisfy the current definition of a planet, where Pluto falls short. "We're pretty sure there's one out there," said Michael E. Brown, a professor of planetary astronomy at the California Institute of Technology. What Dr. Brown and fellow Caltech professor Constantine Batygin have not done is actually find that planet, so it would be premature to revise mnemonics of the planet just yet. Rather, in a paper published Wednesday in the Astronomical Journal, Dr. Brown and Dr. Batygin lay out a detailed, circumstantial argument for the planet's existence in what astronomers have observed, a half dozen small bodies in distant, highly elliptical orbits. What is striking, the scientists said, is that the orbits of all six loop outward in the same quadrant of the solar system and are kind of tilted all about the same angle. The odds of that happening by chance are about 1 in 14,000, Dr. Batygin said. A ninth planet could be gravitationally herding them into these orbits. For the calculations to work, the planet would be quite large, at least as big as Earth, and likely bigger. A mini Neptune with a thick atmosphere around a rocky core with perhaps 10 times the mass of Earth. It would dwarf Pluto at about 4,500 times its mass. Pluto, at its most distant, is 4.6 billion miles from the Sun. The potential ninth planet at its closest would be about 20 billion miles away from the Sun. At its farthest, it could be 100 billion miles away. It would take from 10,000 to 20,000 years to complete one orbit around the Sun. Now, that makes more sense with that 10,000 number that they came up with earlier, huh? And remember, this is the New York Times. They're not talking about Nibiru. They're talking about this other planet they think might be out there that's big with a thick atmosphere and comes around every 10,000 years. Wow. I mean, if you think about this, this article is talking about this planet that was documented in detail by the Sumerians in 3000 BC. That's fucking insane. This is way before some banker had the idea to start the New York Times. From history timeline according to Sitchin, based on the cosmic code, the sixth book of the Earth Chronicles by Zechariah Sitchin. Okay, folks. What I'm about to tell you is what the Sumerians recorded in a historical timeline and through their vast sciences. It involves the fact that we came into contact with the Anunnaki, this alien race, many, many years ago, and they lived here on Earth. I want you to believe this right now. You can think on it later after the show's over, but for the moment, suspend your disbelief. Turn down the lights. Turn on the laser lights. Sit back in your chairs and imagine the planetarium show of a lifetime. In fact, we might need to turn up some really groovy 1987 BCR Science Museum planetarium mood music. If you go to www.beyondthe.black right now, we've set up an image of a planetarium show just so you can sit there and watch it while you listen if you want to look at it that way. Okay, everybody ready? Let's go. Let's go back. Let's go back half a million years ago. The events before the flood. 450,000 BC. On Nibiru, a distant member of our solar system, life faces slow extinction as the planet's atmosphere erodes. Deposed by Anu, the ruler Alalu escapes in a spaceship and finds refuge on Earth. He discovers that Earth has gold that can be used to protect Nibiru's atmosphere. Led by Anki, a son of Anu, the Anunnaki land on Earth and establish Eridu, Earth Station 1, for extracting gold from the waters of the Persian Gulf. 430,000 BC. Earth's climate mellows. More Anunnaki arrive on Earth. Among them is Anki's half-sister Ninhursag, chief medical officer. 416,000 BC. As gold production falters, Anu arrives on Earth with Enlil, the heir apparent. It's decided to obtain the vital gold by mining it in southern Africa. Drawing lots of gold, Enlil wins command of Earth mission. Anki is relegated to Africa. On departing Earth, Anu is challenged by Alalu's grandson. 400,000 BC. Seven functional settlements in southern Mesopotamia include a spaceport called Sippar, a mission control center called Nippur, and a metallurgical center called Shurippak. The ore arrives by ships from Africa. The refined metal is then sent aloft to orbiters manned by Agiji, another Anunnaki king, and then transferred to spaceships arriving periodically from Nibiru. 380,000 BC. Gaining the support of Agiji, Alalu's grandson attempts to seize mastery over Earth. But those in support of Anu's son Enlil win the War of the Olden Gods. 300,000 BC. The Anunnaki toiling in the gold mines mutiny. Looking for an answer, Anki and his sister Ninhursag create primitive workers through genetic manipulation of ape women, and the human is born. These primitive workers then take over the manual chores for the Anunnaki. But Enlil raids the mines and takes the primitive workers to Mesopotamia. Given the ability to procreate, Homo sapiens begin to multiply. 200,000 BC. Life on Earth regresses. With the dawning of a new glacial period, there is a long hiatus of growth. 100,000 BC. The climate warms again. The Anunnaki, to Enlil's growing annoyance, marry and breed with the daughters of men. Pause it. Just a reminder from our talks before, from Genesis 6:4. The Nephilim were on Earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went with the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. All right, back to the timeline. 75,000 BC. The accrescation of Earth. A new ice age begins. Regressive types of man roam the Earth. Cro-Magnon Man survives. 49,000 BC. Anki and his sister Ninrasag elevate humans of Anunnaki parentage and bloodline to rule in Shurahak. Enlil, enraged, plots mankind's demise. 13,000 BC. Realizing that the passage of Nibiru in Earth's proximity will trigger an immense tidal wave, Enlil makes the Anunnaki swear to keep the impending calamity a secret from mankind. After the Flood. 11,000 BC. Anki breaks the oath and instructs Zayasudra, a human, to build a submersible ship. The flood sweeps over the Earth. The Anunnaki witness the total destruction from their orbiting spacecraft. Enlil agrees to grant the remnants of mankind implements and seeds, and agriculture begins in the highlands. Anki domesticates animals. Pause it. Let's talk about the flood for a minute. I'm sure you know that Zayasudra is also Noah, so I'll refer to him as Noah from here on out. But let's talk about what that flood was like. Then there was darkness in daytime, and at night the moon, as though by a monster, was swallowed. The earth began to shake by a net force, or electromagnetic force, before unknown it was agitated. In the glow of the dawn, a black cloud arose from the horizon. The morning's light to darkness changed. The sound of a rolling thunder boomed. Lightnings, the sky, lit up. On that day, on the unforgettable day, the deluge with a roar begun. Let's continue. 10,500 BC. The descendants of Noah are allotted three regions. Ninurta, Enlil's foremost son, dams the mountains and drains the rivers to make Mesopotamia habitable again. Anki reclaims the Nile Valley. The Sinai Peninsula is retained by the Anunnaki for a post-diluvial spaceport, and a control center is established on Mount Moriah, the future Jerusalem. 9,780 BC. Ra, otherwise known as Marduk, Anki's firstborn son, divides dominion over Egypt between Osiris and Seth. 9,330 BC. Seth seizes and dismembers Osiris and assumes sole rule over the Nile Valley. 8,970 BC. Horus avenges his father Osiris by launching the First Pyramid War. Seth escapes to Asia, seizes the Sinai Peninsula, and Canaan. Pause it. Pyramid Wars? I'm coming back to the pyramids right after our little journey through time ends. Let's continue. 8,670 BC. Opposed to the resulting control of all the space facilities by Anki's descendants, the Enlilites launch the Second Pyramid War. The victorious Ninurta empties the Great Pyramid of its equipment. Ninrasag, half-sister of Anki and Enlil, convenes a peace conference. The division of Earth is reaffirmed. Rule over Egypt is transferred from the Ra-Marduk dynasty to that of Tot. Heliopolis is built as a substitute beacon city. 8500 BC. The Anunnaki establish outposts at the gateway to the space facilities. Jericho is one of them. 7400 BC. As the era of peace continues, the Anunnaki grant mankind new advances. The Neolithic period begins, and demigods rule over Egypt. 3800 BC. Urban civilization begins in Sumer as the Anunnaki reestablish there the olden cities, beginning with Eridu and Nippur. Anu comes to Earth for a pageantful visit. A new city, Uruk, is built in his honor. He makes its temple the abode of his beloved granddaughter, Ishtar. Kingship on Earth. 3760 BC. Mankind is granted kingship. Kish is the first capital under the aegis of Ninurta. The first recorded calendar begins at Nippur. Civilization blossoms out in Sumer, the first region. 3450 BC. Marduk proclaims Babylon as the gateway to the gods. The Tower of Babel incident happens. The Anunnaki confuse mankind's languages. His coup frustrated, Marduk, or Ra, returns to Egypt, deposes Tot, and seizes his younger brother Dumuzi, who is betrothed to Ishtar. Dumuzi is accidentally killed. Anu is angry, and Marduk is imprisoned alive in the Great Pyramid. Freed through an emergency shaft, he goes into exile. Pause it. Two things, this Gateway of the Gods reference connects directly back to episode 1 of Beyond the Black, when we talked about the Book of Enoch, the Watchers, and the multidimensional travel theories. Second, a little refresher on the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel is a Near Eastern etiological myth that's recorded in the first book of the Jewish Bible, Genesis. It's meant to explain the origin of different languages. According to the story, a united humanity of generations following the Great Flood, speaking a single language and migrating eastward, came to the land of Shinar. They agreed to build a city and a tower, tall enough to reach the heavens. Seeing this, God viewed such behavior as rude and disrespectful. He confounded their speech and confused their language so they could no longer understand each other and scattered them all around the world. The Tower of Babel has been associated with known structures according to some modern scholars, notably the Edmenike, a ziggurat dedicated to the Mesopotamian god Marduk by Nabopolassar, the king of Babylonia. The Great Ziggurat of Babylon was 91 meters tall, and Alexander the Great had it demolished in 331. But anyway, the Book of Jubilee contains one of the most detailed accounts found anywhere of the tower. And they began to build. And in the fourth week they made brick with fire, and the bricks served them with stone, and the clay which with they had cemented them together was asphalt, which comes out of the sea, and out of the fountains of water in the line of Shinar. And they built it. 43 years they were building it. Its breadth was 203 bricks. And while the height of a brick was the third of one long ways, its height amounted to 5,433 cubits and 2 palms. And the extent was 13 strades. The story goes as such. 1. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. 2. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. 3. And they said, "Come, let's build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." 4. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. 5. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them." 6. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. 7. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city. 8. Therefore its name is called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all of the earth. Now see, both of those stories are so similar, with the Anunnaki and God being the two players. I mean, it's hard to ignore that the Sumerian version of this was written way before the Bible. So, was it God? Or was it aliens? Let's continue a little bit further into the modern Sumerian age. 3100 BC. Years of chaos end with the installation of the first Egyptian pharaoh in Memphis. Civilization comes to the second region. 2900 BC. Kingship in Sumer transferred to Uruk. Ishtar is given dominion over the third region. The Indus Valley civilization begins. 2650 BC. Sumer's royal capital shifts about, kingship deteriorates, Enlil loses patience with unruly human multitudes. 2371 BC. Ishtar falls in love with Sargon. He establishes a new capital city, Akkad. The Akkadian Empire is launched. 2316 BC. Aiming to rule all four regions, Sargon removes sacred soil from Babylon. The Marduk-Ishtar conflict flares up again. It ends when Nergal, Marduk's brother, journeys from South Africa to Babylon and persuades Marduk to leave Mesopotamia. Now, folks, this stuff goes on a little bit longer, but we've kind of gotten to the bulk of what I wanted to explore. I wanted you guys to hear the story about how they came to Earth, created the humans, and took over. And we crisscrossed with the Bible a couple times. So let's take a step out of our time travel thing now and move on. As you can see, much of this story's framework mirrors tales from the Bible and various other religions and world mythologies. Even Scientology and the whole Xenu saga has touches of this kind of story. The underappreciated and mistreated author Graham Hancock, in his book Fingerprints of the Gods, even talks about how wrong mainstream archaeology is on human history, the ages of megalithic structures such as pyramids, and how long civilization has truly been on this planet. And much to the chagrin of mainstream scientists, he backs all of his theories up and makes excellent cases for most, if not all of them. Not that the quote-unquote mainstream anything would ignore or censor anything, let alone theories that would challenge current beliefs. Anyway, speaking of pyramids, all that business about the Pyramid Wars, let's get clear on what that was referring to. Thus began a tale inscribed on the temple walls of the ancient Egyptian city of Edfu. It is the tale, we believe, of what could only be called the First Pyramid War. A war that had its roots in the never-ending struggle for control over Earth and its space facilities, and in the shenanigans of the great Anunnaki, especially Anki and his son Marduk. Let's talk about the pyramids themselves for a minute. From an article on humansarefree.com, the head of Cairo's University and Archaeology Department, Professor Dr. Ali Shahin, has allegedly stated in a conference on ancient Egyptian science that there might be truth to the theory that aliens helped the ancient Egyptians build the pyramids of Giza. Being further questioned by Mr. Marek Novak, a delegate from Poland, as to whether the pyramid might still contain alien technology or even a UFO within its structure, Dr. Shaheen was vague and replied, "I cannot confirm or deny this, but there is something inside the pyramid that is not of this world." He continued to state the following facts about the Great Pyramids. 1. The Great Pyramids are constructed out of 2,500,000 solid blocks, perfectly aligned. 2. The blocks weigh between 2.5 and 10 tons each, enough stone for the construction of 25 Empire State Buildings. 3. Initially, the Great Pyramid was covered in limestone. According to Mark Antonius, it was visible from 160 kilometers, and it was shining like a precious jewel. 4. 150,000 stone blocks, weighing 10 tons each, were removed in the 14th century for the construction of the city of Cairo. 5. We are taught that the Great Pyramid was built as a tomb for the pharaoh Khufu, but the modern discoveries show otherwise. Khufu's name was discovered in the so-called mortuary chamber, inside the pyramid, but nobody speaks about it until 1837. One of the most important Egyptologists, Zechariah Sitchin, discovered that the writing is a fraud and was painted in May of 1837. Everything started with a letter received from Alan Pittsburgh. He wrote that his great-grandfather witnessed the fraud. Because he objected to this counterfeiting, he was fired from the team and expelled from Giza. After examining the writing, Sitchin discovered that it was indeed a fraud, especially because the counterfeiters misspelled the pharaoh's name. Instead of Khufu, they wrote Rufu, which for the Egyptians would have been worse than taking the Lord's name in vain in a Christian church. Sitchin concluded this would never have happened in ancient Egypt. 6. Khufu's alleged sarcophagus was almost half his size and carved directly into stone. Not only could the pharaoh not fit, but it was also not suited for a royalty. The so-called Queen's Mortuary Chamber is sealed by a huge stone box and doesn't even contain a sarcophagus. The cover-up is even more obvious because the official story claims that the queen was to be cremated after her death. This never happened in the entire Egyptian history because in order for a royalty to become a god, the mummification process was mandatory. 7. No mummies were ever found in any of the Great Pyramids of Giza. Not a single one. What we learn today is fact can't even stand as substantial theories. The article then continues to state the following facts, which the author believes proves that the pyramids were not built by man. Evidence: the Great Pyramids had not been built by the Egyptians. 1. Nobody knows what the word pyramid really means, and no roots for this word were ever found anywhere on Earth. 2. None of the historian's statements regarding the pyramids have ever been proven. 3. They say the pyramids were built as tombs for the mummified pharaohs, but not a single mummy was ever found inside the Great Pyramids. 4. The Egyptians had no knowledge of modern geology, and without this knowledge, it's impossible for such a construction to not crumble or sink. In the modern construction industry, the engineers consider a sinking rate of 15 centimeters in 100 years acceptable. In 5,000 years, which is according to the official version, because there is no evidence that the Great Pyramids might be 10,000 years old, the Great Pyramid weighs 6,350,000 tons. That's 14 billion pounds, and sank only 1.5 centimeters. 5. In modern constructions, it's an extraordinary achievement to keep each side of the building at a deviation of 15 centimeters. But the Great Pyramid has a deviation of only 0.75 centimeters. That's impossible to replicate today, even with all of the modern technology we have at our fingertips. 6. The stone blocks are placed with the tolerance of 1,000th to 2,000th of an inch, so precisely that a razor blade doesn't fit between them. 7. The mathematicians say, during the construction of the pyramids, the Egyptians should have used several very advanced concepts and formulas, which have allegedly been discovered only thousands of years later. BS. 8. The geographical orientation of the Great Pyramids is probably the most amazing characteristic. Its sides are almost perfectly placed from north to south and east to west, being almost perfectly oriented with Earth's true north. How was a civilization from a quasi-stone age capable of determining the true north? 9. The construction of the Great Pyramid shows extraordinary astronomical knowledge. The constructors could measure the day, the year, and could precisely determine the equinox. They knew that the Earth is a sphere, and they knew how to accurately calculate its longitude and latitude. 10. The studies show that from the pyramid's top, an energetic vortex is emanated that extends in diameter the higher it reaches. 11. The studies also show that the Egyptian Sphinx is at least 5,000 years older than the history books say, which means that it's at least 10,000 years old, while others say it could be as old as 15,000 years. 12. In 1813, the astronomer Richard Proctor discovered from ancient archives that the Great Pyramids were indeed aligned to the stars. It's also been discovered that the pyramids are highly receptive of radio energetic waves, and even cosmic microwaves. Above the so-called mortuary chamber inside the Great Pyramid, there are 5 huge granite tiles placed in layers, with spaces in between them. The layers end with some kind of V-shaped roof pointing up. Okay, so we can clearly say that there's a great probability that the pyramids were built with help from a technologically advanced civilization. Okay. Let's dig even crazier deep. Let's get a little weird here. In an excerpt from IN5D.com, governments rarely tell us the truth and cover their trails with the excuses of the information being confidential or a security risk. So it's quite possible that most governments know about the return of the Anunnaki, yet fear telling the people because it would collapse their economic slave structure and world religions as we know them. A thought to ponder comes from the Christian Bible, the King James Version. In Genesis 1:26, it states, "And God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness.'" One must question why it says, "Let us make man in our image." If there's one God, then it should read, "And God said, 'Let me make man in my own image.'" Is it possible that the Bible was written by the Anunnaki and designed to control man through fear? After all, religion equals subservience, control, and conformity, which is the same template as every government. And for the record, the King James Version of the Bible was edited by Sir Francis Bacon, father of the Rosicrucians, and a 33-degree Freemason. At this level of Freemasonry, there is a motto of Ordo Ab Chao, which means order out of chaos. The Bible ends in chaos with the chapter called Revelation. In the Sumerian tale, Anki disobeys his father Anu and loves the human creations. Anki and Anu have been at war ever since this betrayal. Anu was the king of kings and the creator god who manipulated our DNA to make us slave workers who would mine the gold on this planet for the Anunnaki. This is most likely the reason the Roman Catholic Church is in possession of so much gold. According to one source, it's estimated that the Roman Catholic Church owns 60,350 metric tons of gold. If you look at the pyramid on the back of the US dollar, you'll see the all-seeing eye. Is it possible that the entity or entities at the top of the pyramid are the Anunnaki and have kept us as economic slaves for thousands of years? Regardless of how this plays out, people are awaking to the tyranny and oppression of all governments and realizing that our current ways of life are unsustainable through fiat currency and other current economic slave systems. Ding, 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 Bitcoin. In total, there may be several thousand world leaders who are keeping us all in economic slavery while knowingly polluting our water, air, and food supplies. The mainstream media continues to play the fear card as well as crank out as much state-sponsored propaganda as possible. We can all rise above this, and it could literally happen overnight. But first, the bottom of the pyramid, all of us, must unite. We can no longer tolerate the hatred of other countries, ethnicities, or races, because this is what keeps us from advancing as a civilization. The Hopi believe that we're the ones that we've been waiting for. In other words, we have the power to change things right now, without the help from the Anunnaki, or any other possible benevolent ET race. But first, we must unite as a global community. Unite. That's the answer. Love is the only truth. Everything else is illusion. One last little thing I want to say before we move to black ribbons. It's the Nephilim thing. See, the Anunnaki and the Watchers, they seem the same. From the Book of Enoch, the sons of God slept with the daughters of man and gave birth to the forbidden creatures. We know both these different angles are telling the same story in different forms, like folklore, but the angels and the watchers and the Anunnaki are the same thing. They came, they were different, they spoke a different tongue, and they created this bloodline. This whole backbone of my album Black Ribbons and this show, Beyond the Black, is about this same story, this bloodline, the reptiles. And we're going to get right back to all of that later in the series. Now, to wrap it up, I move to the song, Black Ribbons.
Broke down at the end of the night, can't seem to get anything right. So numb I can't feel things anymore, but somehow can feel me letting go. I know there's so many things that I need to do and I need to say. No matter how hard I try, I can't get the words out of my man down, tie a ribbon around my soul. I'm in the black and I'm out of control. Like a ship that's lost in the night, with no direction or a guiding light. But somehow I can't keep you out of my rain. I see you standing in the rain.
Well, this song is personal. I was feeling really beat up after my experience with leaving a major label, having a fallout with a major band member, and just generally feeling lost. So I wrote a song about how I felt. And a lot of kind folks have come up to me and shared their appreciation for that song. It's personal, and it means a lot to me. But I thought I could take this moment to shine a focus on a very important topic to me, veterans. There's a lot of young soldiers who have come to my shows and talked to me about experiences abroad in a very scary war, and have shared these stories about how they were listening to my music and Leroy Powell's music or Hank Three's music while they were over there risking their lives for my freedom to make these silly records. It means a fucking lot. And the fact that re-entry into society is still made so fucking hard for these heroes is just unjust, unconstitutional, and goddamn mean-spirited. I'm sorry. I get worked up over things like this because you hear a lot of stories about these young men coming back, becoming drug addicts, they don't get help, they become homeless, it's just heartbreaking. But these men give their lives, and they risk everything because our country says, we need you. They don't ask questions, they just answer the call. That says something huge, folks. I know Election Day is coming, and to me, honestly, it's feeling a little heartbreaking right now, all of it. I'm not sure I can even continue to watch it without getting physically sick, not because of either candidate, but just because how this country is treating one another, At this time, I've never seen such a divided country. Race wars, terror wars, horror wars. There are and will always be heroes, and God bless those heroes. And God bless America, the place a lot of us have watched become disgraced and dishonored. This is our land, and these are our brothers and sisters. And we come before you with gratitude to forgive us. We've not known what we've done until now. We stand united as the sovereign front, built on truth, honesty, and spiritual harmony, undivided, unbroken. God bless the veterans. Until next show, kids, please email me. Tell me your stories. I've written everyone back so far, and I'm loving what I'm being sent. My email, once again, is shooter@beyondthe.black. I invite you to write me and debunk any of these stories or correct me, or even just tell me you like it or tell me about something else I should be digging up. shooter@beyondthe.black. I want to thank you guys for your time, as time is the most valuable commodity in the world. Thanks for traversing the borders of the commonplace and going beyond the black with us tonight. I'll see you on the other side. And remember, children, love is the only truth. Everything else is illusion. And black is the only color that's real.
Tie a ribbon for the child and me on every door and on every tree. Make it black for the way that I feel, 'cause black is the only color that's real.
Secure transmission. Stay tuned for future messages. Everything is illusion.